It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Expectations are high for Nathan Hill's debut novel. He's been compared to the novelist John Irving, and John Irving is comparing him to Charles Dickens. The novel is called The Nix. That's spelled N-I-X. And it's hard to really tell you what it's about, because it's about love, loss, secrets, a mother and a son, a father and a daughter, politics, video game addiction, academia, and, of course, Norwegian folklore. The character at the center of it all, Samuel Anderson Anderson, does bear a passing resemblance with his creator, Nathan Hill, who was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and he majored in English and journalism at the University of Iowa. But that was quite a while ago. He now lives in Naples, Florida, and is with me today. Nathan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm happy to do it.
Well, can you introduce us a little bit to this character, Samuel Anderson Anderson, who, as I mentioned, does share a few autobiographical details with you, but this is a work of fiction, and you've made that very clear. But tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, I've had to tell my former employers that it's definitely a work of fiction because, like me, Samuel is or was an English teacher, a professor of English at a university who teaches freshman composition. So those classes, you know, freshmen take them and they learn how to write an essay in college. Now, that's what I did for a living for 9 or 10 years, and I gave Samuel that same job. But Samuel hates it. He hates it quite a lot more than I ever did. I actually like teaching quite a lot, but that doesn't make for very good drama. So Samuel is in a pretty bad place. He resents his students. He resents his lack of success as a writer. And he spends most of his time with a video game called World of Elfscape. It's basically my ripoff of World of Warcraft.
And he is quickly approaching, although he doesn't quite know it yet, a major... actually like 6 major crises in his life all at the same time. And we won't give anything away. But I'm curious. I know that this is a novel that kind of grew organically for you over time. And one of your original impetuses was to write a novel about politics. And there are certainly politics in this novel. But tell me a little bit about the journey you took from politics to this kind of 600-page epic.
I started writing the book in 2004, and the first impulse was I'd moved to New York City in August 2004, and I had gone down to watch the protests at the Republican National Convention at Madison Square Garden. And that was where the first ideas came from. You know, people were, you know, pretty angry. This was Bush Cheney's second term. They were protesting the war in Iraq. And I had the idea to write about somebody at that protest. And, you know, I was a young man. I was in my, mid-late 20s at the time, very politically aggressive. And I thought I would write this really heavy-handed political novel. And thank goodness I gave that up eventually because as I kept, you know, looking into some of the things that I was writing about, I realized it's probably obvious to anybody, but to me, I was so naive. I realized, you know, I really had no idea what I was talking about. Like, what were the odds that that from my very limited point of view, I had the capital T truth about American politics? So instead, I gave up on writing some sanctimonious novel, and instead, I became much more interested in the ways that we as, you know, individuals sort of glance off of historical or political movements. And so that gave me the idea of maybe I should place these people, my characters, in moments in political history. So Occupy Wall Street, the 2004 convention, the 1968 convention in Chicago, but not necessarily as a way to say, like, this person's right and this person's wrong, but much more just as an investigation to the kind of abstract relationship we have with politics throughout our lives.
The political thread does continue through the book, not just historically, but in a contemporary way, although it takes place in the summer of 2011. There is this character in the book, Governor Packer, who is a Tea Party type Republican candidate, and he's sort of testing the waters for a presidential run. And a lot of the rhetoric that he uses sounds a lot like the kind of rhetoric that we've been hearing a lot of over the last couple of years. Were you concerned at any point that your political satire was being outstripped by real life?
It's pretty weird, right? Yeah, I had to go back into my notebooks because enough people had asked me about the Packer character. I had to look back in my notebooks. I wrote that guy something like 8 years ago. That scene at the beginning was written about 8 years ago now. So I certainly didn't model him on real life, but the fact that everybody is saying like, oh, you must have written that to reflect the current political season just seems it's an obvious example of reality becoming much weirder than fiction very quickly.
Well, and you do push the edge of realistic with a lot of your characters. You take a step beyond to make it funny and to make it intriguing. And with Governor Packer, I didn't feel like we really stepped beyond that edge.
I felt like I was way beyond the edge when I was writing him. You know, when I wrote him, I was like, nobody's ever going to say anything like that out loud. And then sure enough, 8 years later, saying those things out loud is just commonplace.
Well, speaking of saying things out loud, there is some lampooning of academia that goes on in your book as well. And there's this amazing encounter that takes place between Samuel Anderson and one of his students. As you mentioned, he's teaching a freshman English course, and one of his students has been called into his office. And what follows is a very long nightmare scenario encounter for any teacher of anything. But I was wondering if you could read just a little bit of that for us.
Sure, I'd be happy to. "You think I cheated?" says Laura Potsdam, college sophomore and habitual perpetual cheater. "You think I plagiarized that paper? Me?" Samuel nods. He's trying to look sad about this whole situation, like when a parent has to punish a child. "This hurts me more than it hurts you" is the expression he's trying to produce, even if he does not sincerely feel it. Inside, he secretly likes when he gets to fail a student. It's like revenge for having to teach them. "Can I just say, once and for all, I did not plagiarize that paper," Laura Potsdam says of the paper that was almost entirely plagiarized. Samuel knows this because of the software, the truly exceptional software package subscribed to by the university that analyzes every essay completed by his students and compares them to every other essay in its massive archive of every paper ever analyzed anywhere. The software's inner brain is made of literally millions of words written by the nation's high school and college students, and Samuel sometimes jokes to his colleagues that if the software ever achieved sci-fi artificial intelligence and consciousness, it would immediately go to Cancun for spring break. The software analyzed Laura's paper and found it to be 99% plagiarized. Everything had been stolen except for the name Laura Potsdam.
And that interaction continues for the next 17 pages with Laura Potsdam making excuse after excuse. And you broke it up in a very funny way with different kinds of arguments, which is what she's supposed to be studying and understanding, and she's not. Now, as a former teacher, to create this nightmare student, did you draw on experiences that you had with students?
Yes, I did. There are plenty of Laura Potsdams out there. I should say that most of my students, everywhere I've taught, have been, you know, wonderful, hardworking people. But there are enough Laura Potsdams out there. These students who plagiarize their paper or cheat on various assignments and feel entitled to get a really good grade regardless, that whenever I would talk about work with some of my colleagues who also did what I did, we would all have the same horror stories. And we started thinking there was something sort of generationally wrong. Like if you do a Google search for plagiarism epidemic, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's happening all over. So this chapter, I sort of conceived of it as maybe like the worst student of all time runs into the worst teacher of all time. So let's just see what happens. So it's amped up beyond anything I experienced in real life. But but Laura is probably an amalgam of maybe 14 or 15 actual encounters I had with students.
I'm talking with Nathan Hill. His debut novel, The Nix, that's N-I-X, has just been released, and he's coming to Iowa City for the Iowa City Book Festival. He'll be reading at Prairie Lights at 1 p.m. on Saturday, October 8th, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Nathan Hill. He's the author of the new book, The Nix. That's spelled N-I-X, and it is an epic novel, about 600 pages, that covers so much territory, a lot of personal territory, relationship, a fraught relationship between a mother and a son and a father and a daughter. It's also about politics and history and video games and academia and our society in general. And just before the break, we were talking a little bit about a student that you created who's sort of the nightmare scenario student for any college teacher to encounter. And as you just described it, the worst student possible encounters the worst professor or the worst teacher possible. And we get to see what happens. And there are so many different elements in this novel that give us insight. And again, I mean, you're pushing the envelope on a lot of these to the point of satire, but there's still a lot of truth in what you're writing. There are so many different elements of different parts of life with academics and politics and love and relationships and the protest movement. You write about a couple of different protest movements and the publishing world and all of these different things. You have kind of, it almost seems like an agenda that you want to share on each of these subjects that is voiced by your different characters. Were there different things that were sort of competing to get out there when you were writing the novel?
It's funny. Some of the stuff that people are calling satire is just reality with a different name. You know, sometimes reality is just so silly that you just give it a slightly different name and you can see how ridiculous it is. For example, somebody in the book is starting a new diet. It's called the Pleisto diet, and it's they eat only foods that people ate in the Pleistocene, specifically the Taurantian epoch during the last ice age. And that's just very slightly different from what actually exists in the world. Similarly, Laura, the student you were talking about, is obsessed with a social media app called iFeel, where she gets to broadcast her emotions to her friends, and then her friends can then select to respond, ignore, or auto care, and most of them just auto care, and that is also not that different from just clicking a like button on Facebook. So, there's a lot of satire, but it's also I feel like I'm cheating because I'm not really changing that much. I'm just kind of presenting some of the things we already do, myself included, but you just give it a slightly different name. And suddenly sometimes you can see the absurdity of it.
Well, it also made me think that the novel will have at least a longer life maybe because of that too, because you refer to a lot of things that I'm very familiar with, but you do it sort of in a sideways way where you are giving it a little bit different name. And of course, right now I can think exactly what you're talking about with World of Warcraft or Facebook or whatever it is, but in 10 years, it'll be something else that resonates with people in that exact same way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was hoping it would have somewhat of a shelf life, but mostly, especially with the Warcraft thing, I needed to change the name because I just did not want to be beholden to that fan base. Like they are militant, you know, with their and extraordinarily knowledgeable about their subject. So I needed my video game to be a little more flexible than they would have allowed.
Well, and let's talk about video games a little bit. Are you a gamer yourself?
I'm not currently a gamer. I went through a period from around 2004 to around 2000, let's say 7, where I played a lot, but then I eventually had to give it up. So I haven't really gotten back into it.
And would you have described yourself as maybe having a problem, maybe being addicted as a gamer during that time?
I wouldn't say that I was addicted. I would say that sometimes gaming interfered with my with the rest of my life. And you know, those websites were, you know, they have questions on you know, do you have an addiction? Do you have a problem? Ask yourself these questions. Do you play longer? Do you play longer than you intended to? Do you lie about how long you play? Do you sit down and play more than 5 hours at a time? Does playing interfere with other relationships? There was a point in my life where I probably could have said yes to those questions. It's funny. I have a sort of love-hate relationship with gaming. On the one hand, it's a whole lot of fun. I met a lot of people, a lot of very cool people, gaming, and it sort of got me through a bit of a dark time in my life. You know, I had just gotten out of school. I really didn't know what I was doing in my career. I wasn't making any money. Like a month after moving to New York City, all of my things were stolen. So I literally had nothing. But
and including your computer, your hard drive that had everything you'd written on it.
Exactly.
Right?
So I had to start over, and so I was really, really depressed. And so it was very easy to feel like completely out of control in my life. But a friend of mine got me hooked on this video game, and in that realm, I felt very in control. In that realm, I felt like very powerful. You know, I was very successful there, whereas I wasn't very successful in the rest of life. So it got me through a tough time. But you know, fast forward 3 years, and I started resenting how much time the game was taking me away from my real life, and I eventually had to give it up when I realized I was gaming more than writing. And so that was about 2007, and unsurprisingly, the writing in the novel took off right around that time.
Well, speaking of writing and gaming getting in the way of it, that's something that, again, you share with the main character, Samuel Anderson. But there's another character in the book, and we never even learn his real name. We know his screen name, Pwnage. But he plays a pivotal role in the book, and he also has an extreme video game addiction. I would love for you to read from a little bit from the chapter where we really learn at least a little bit about Pwnage and his life.
Sure, this is where Pwnage first starts, first appears, and he has been playing the world of Elfscape all day. He hadn't intended to play the game today. He certainly hadn't intended to play as long as he did. Today was supposed to be the first day of his new diet. Today was the day he had vowed to start eating better. Fruits and vegetables and lean proteins and no trans fats and nothing processed and reasonable portions and carefully balanced meals of huge nutritional abundance beginning today. And he launched his brand new eating better lifestyle that very morning by cracking open a Brazil nut and chewing it and swallowing it, because Brazil nuts were one of the top 5 foods you're not eating enough of, according to the diet book he bought in preparation for today, along with the diet book's sequel books and the diet's associated meal plans and mobile device apps, all of which advocated a cuisine made up largely of animal proteins and nuts, basically hunter-gatherer. And he thought about all the heart-healthy good fats and antioxidants and metanutrients inside the Brazil nut pouring through his own body, doing helpful things like zapping free radicals and lowering his cholesterol and hopefully strengthening his energy levels, because there was so much to do. The kitchen urgently needed renovation. The countertop laminate was cracking and curling at the edges, and the dishwasher stopped working last spring, and the garbage disposal died maybe a year ago, and 3 of the 4 burners on the stove were useless, and the refrigerator had lately gone insane. The fridge side shutting down unpredictably and spoiling hot dogs and lunch meats and souring milk, while the freezer side occasionally went hyperactive and locked all his TV dinners in permafrost. Also, the kitchen cabinets needed to be cleared of various plastic collections of Tupperware gone yellow with age, and the forgotten bags of dried fruit or nuts or potato chips, and the many small cylindrical containers of herbs and spices arranged in geologic layers formed by his previous attempts to start new diets, each attempt requiring the purchase of whole new sets of herbs and spices, because in the time elapsed since the last serious attempt, the old herbs and spices fused within their jars into single, unusable, dehydrated chunks. And he knew he should open up all the cabinets and throw everything away and make sure there were no colonies of bacteria or bugs living in the farthest, darkest back corners. But he didn't really want to open the cabinets and check for bugs, because he was afraid of what he might find, namely bugs, because then he'd have to put up plastic and fumigate and clear space elsewhere to create a kind of staging area in which to pile the necessary parts, the new cabinetry and planks for the hardwood flooring and the new appliances and the various hammers, saws, boxes of nails, screws, PVC pipes, and other things necessary for drastic kitchen reconstruction. Though, looking around the house, he understood how difficult this was going to be. The living room, for example, had to be a no-construction debris zone in case some evening in the future he found himself entertaining unexpected guests, meaning Lisa, who would not find heaps of tools inviting or romantic. Same with the bedroom, also a bad staging area choice for exactly the same reason, though, admittedly, it had been quite a while since Lisa had come over, mostly because she insisted they maintain their distance during this new phase of their relationship, an edict that did not stop her from asking for rides to work and to various mini-malls to complete various errands, and just because Lisa had divorced him didn't mean he would let her hang high and dry without a driver's license and a car, and while he knew most guys would do exactly that, he was just raised differently.
That's Nathan Hill reading from his new novel, The Knicks, and that was the character Pwnage, who has a serious video game addiction, but while I wanted to feel superior to Pwnage in reading that chapter and feel like, oh my gosh, here's a guy with a terrible problem, the kind of problem I could never experience, I think it's really easy to see yourself, or at least it was for me, to see myself in him, because we all have those goals that we think about and maybe even make a plan, but just get in our own way when we try to accomplish them. And I was really struck by how human, likable, and sympathetic this extreme character was.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, he started as a sort of joke, and then I realized that I was doing so much, so many of the things that he also does. I mean, the thing about Pwnage is something that we all experience, which is that he thinks that he is going to be sometime in the future a way better person than he is right now. And I think we all do that to a degree, right? I mean, we get gym memberships and then maybe rarely go, or we load up our Netflix queue with like deep, heavy Oscar winners, and then on a day-to-day basis find ourselves watching, I don't know, Iron Man or something. And we think. In the future, we're going to finally start that diet, or finally stop playing video games, or renovate the kitchen. But on a day-to-day basis, what's most easy to do is for Pwnage, he'll start playing Elfscape again. And I think to a degree we all sort of do that. We hope that we're going to be better people, but it when it really comes down to it, in the very small, tiny day-to-day choices, it's actually very, very difficult to be as good as we want to be.
Well, and one of the things that really loved about Pwnage is how he's so incredibly hopeless in his own life, but he's very skilled in World of Elfscape. And then there comes a time when he can offer advice and counsel to Samuel, the main character of the book, and it's brilliant advice. I mean, it just breaks down a problem and makes it solvable in a way that it hadn't been before, and he used video game logic to get there.
Yeah, his whole philosophy of life is based on the four challenges that one faces in a video game. And the four challenges are enemies, obstacles, puzzles, and traps. And so he thinks that any problem, or really any person you encounter in life, is one of those four things: an enemy, obstacle, puzzle, or trap. So if they're an enemy, you just have to eliminate them in somehow. If they're an obstacle, you have to find your way around them. The problem is between the puzzle and the trap. As he says at one point, sometimes it's hard to tell those apart. You think something's a puzzle until you realize it's a trap, but by then it's too late. That's the trap.
Well, and that's really sound advice, at least in this scenario it was. But do you feel like maybe you do gain some ability to reason and solve logical problems by playing video games?
I don't know. I don't know. I know that when I was like in fourth grade and begging my parents for Nintendo, I made some really silly argument about hand-eye coordination that they totally did not buy.
I remember that one, yeah.
I don't know. I think with his philosophy, it's not that the people themselves could be, let's say, enemies or puzzles or obstacles or traps. It's how we choose to see them. In a way, you know, we have some degree of choice and control over this. So you can be a person who sees everybody else as an enemy, and indeed a lot of the characters at the beginning of the novel do just that. But it takes a kind of radical act of will. But it's also possible to see those same people as puzzles and not necessarily as enemies, but rather as things to solve, things to figure out. And I hope that the argument of the book is that doing that, it creates a life that's much less punishing and much less toxic than constantly thinking you're surrounded by enemies.
I'm talking with Nathan Hill. He's the author of the new novel, The Nix. It's his debut novel. He was born in Cedar Rapids, went to the University of Iowa. He now lives in Naples, Florida, but he will be in Iowa City for the Iowa City Book Festival. He'll be reading at Prairie Lights at 1 p.m. on Saturday, October 8th. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Nathan Hill. He's the author of the new novel, The Nix, a novel that is getting a lot of attention right now and is expected to be a very, very big book. It's his debut novel. He's being compared to John Irving. John Irving's comparing him to Charles Dickens, which is a pretty incredible compliment, both coming from John Irving and just being made, period. So I'm sure you didn't expect any of this with your debut novel. How does it feel?
It feels a really surprising, really shocking. I'm sort of waiting for all of it to somehow go away. It's been too good. You know, I worked on this novel for a long time, mostly in secret. I wasn't like keeping it from people. I just didn't feel like talking about it. Eventually, you know, you work on a novel for, you know, more than 5 years, let's say, and suddenly your friends are like, oh, right, you're working on your novel, with like air quotes, you know? And so I just kind of stopped talking about it. I threw myself into teaching, and the only person who knew anything about what I was doing was my wife, who heard the book all the way through, out of order, but all the way through in those 10 years that I was working on it. And so, you know, there's this fear that maybe only she and I, maybe it only makes sense to my wife and I. Maybe it doesn't make sense to anyone else. And so the fact that we're getting all of this attention and people are saying really nice things is stunning and obviously gratifying, and it's all still too new, so I can't tell you how I'm processing it other than just being blown away constantly just about every day.
The main character, Samuel Anderson Anderson, is a writer, and he is really stuck in his career. And one of the big reasons that he's stuck is because he has been writing to a very specific audience. He's been trying to impress a girl ever since he started writing, and he can't seem to get past writing and shaping his writing based on what she will think of him. But that's something a lot of writers experience, the idea of the audience for the writing getting in the way of the creation of the writing. Was that something that you experienced early on?
Sure. When I first moved to New York, I was right out of grad school, and I moved there with a few writer friends that were colleagues of mine in my program. And I remember one of them saying something like, you know, we have a couple years to make it big, or else we're just another washed up MFA-er. And I was dumb enough and naive enough at the time to take that seriously. And I was like, I don't want to be a washed up MFA-er. And besides, I just, you know, gone into a little bit of debt getting an MFA in creative writing. I told my parents I was doing this crazy thing, and so now is the time to prove that I was right about it. And so I started writing these stories that in hindsight I was writing them for all the wrong reasons. You know, I was trying to, you know, place them in certain tiers of journals so I could get, you know, the attention of agents and editors and get, you know, good things on my CV to get a good teaching job somewhere. And it was just, they were all just like widgets to try to help me get what I want. And so unsurprisingly, the stories were very bad. And so it wasn't until I sort of gave up all of that, and stopped querying and stopped sending stuff out and stopped worrying about it so much, that the novel really sort of took off on me, and I got to sort of imbue the book with a lot of the anxiety that I had been feeling. I gave it all to Samuel, who really resents that he'd never lived up to his potential.
Now, speaking of experiences not living up to potential, there are many moments in the book where characters have an opportunity to learn something and mature and hopefully go on and become happier individuals. And almost all of your characters blow opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to grow and learn. Is there some cynicism that you carry about the human ability to grow and learn?
I hope not, because I feel like, I don't want to say it's a happy ending, but I feel like they're in a much better place by the end of the novel, certainly than they were at the beginning. I think it's not necessarily cynicism. In fact, I hope that I forgive them their foibles, as I hope that anybody would forgive me with the mistakes I've made in my past. I think it's really easy to, you know, when we're faced in one of those decisions where maybe we could grow and become a better person, it's very easy to be selfish about that, to be sort of tunnel vision-y, to not see it for what it is at the time, and then later to internalize your decision and make it seem to yourself like, no, that was the right thing to do. And, you know, we always want to be the good guy in the story of our own lives, you know? And so I think it's really easy to not be critical and not grow.
And assume you're the good guy all along.
Exactly. And so I hope that it doesn't come off as cynicism so much as just, when you step back and you really evaluate yourself, like, you know, do so in such a way that you don't assume that you're right all the time. And I think that's what the characters finally figure out somewhere near the end of the book.
Well, in reading the book, I got to about 125 pages away from the end, and I was starting to get worried because it didn't feel like there was that much time to wrap things up. And you'd made me love all these people so much, and you didn't let me down at all. So if anybody else who experiences anxiety, just keep going. I want to talk about Iowa before we run out of time, because that's something else that you share, again, with this main character. He was born in Iowa, and he returns to his hometown in Iowa, which is just this lovely blend of a lot of familiar things to anybody who's spent any time in Iowa. There's a lot of Cedar Rapids, but it's also a river town on the Mississippi. What was your inspiration? What towns did you spend a lot of time in?
Well, you've nailed them already. Yeah. So my extended family were farmers and outside of Clinton, Iowa, and then my mom grew up in Comanche, Iowa. I was born in Cedar Rapids and then lived in Comanche and Clinton for a few years and then moved to Des Moines. And so, yeah, a lot of the descriptions are blends of a lot of those places, those landscapes and those landscapes that I really love, and they feel at home for me. I would spend growing up, my family moved away from Iowa, and we kind of bopped around the country a bit. But growing up, I would always come back to the farm every summer. And so I feel like coming back to Iowa City for college, it just felt like coming back home again.
There's this thread of Norwegian folklore that goes through the book. That's where the title of the book, The Nix, comes from. And there are, of course, a lot of people in Iowa who are of Norwegian descent. Is that something else you share?
Sure. So on my mother's side, three or four generations back, moved from Norway to a little town in Minnesota. And then after spending, maybe roughly 10, 15, 20 years in Minnesota, moved to Iowa. And so yeah, my mom's side is Norwegian, but we don't have much contact with, we don't have any contact with that part of the family. That line just kind of evaporated. So I always knew it was part of my family's history, but we didn't have any information about it. And so in this book, I go back to Norway, and it was almost as if it was my opportunity to invent the family history that I don't actually have.
Now, speaking of all of that, we've talked about the similarities between you and Samuel. Samuel's mother is a very, very big part of this book. And I know that you had to assure your mother that she is nothing like Faye.
Yeah, Faye, in the book, the character of Faye, the mom, is very cold at times, like very, I mean, she's even mean, and my mom is a very warm, supportive person who certainly did not abandon the family when I was 11 years old. That is all invented. So I had to tell her that, because whenever I, you know, when I was writing the book, whenever I needed some neat mom detail, I would reach from my life, or more accurately, hers. And so the mom in the book grew up in the same place that my mom grew up. They have very similar stories. But they're very, very different people. So I had to warn my mom, you know, this is going to seem familiar, but I promise it's not you.
So spending about a decade writing this novel and then having it come to fruition, and, you know, the early success that you've already experienced with it, does that influence how you write now?
It's funny. I'm really enjoying this moment, but I'm also very aware that I'm trying to write the next book, and you know, I sit down to write, and there's a blank page, and that page does not care what John Irving said about me. You know, like that the blank page does not care about the reviews or anything like that. It's still going to be blank, you know, regardless. So you still have to put words on the paper, and there's still work to do. So I'm trying to, you know, on the one hand, enjoy what's happening, because I recognize that it's rare and precious, but also not to let it go too much to my head, because yeah, there's some work to be done, and I want the next book to be really good.
You plumbed so many different areas of life and history and culture in this book. Does it feel like you used up too many things?
Well, I got married while I was writing this book, and I think the next book is going to be about marriage. So there's a brand new territory unplumbed.
All right. So as you continue to grow and change, then.
Exactly.
So. Oh, interesting. Well, as you're traveling around the country on your book tour, what is it like to be face to face with your readers, that imagined audience that you've been writing to for so many years?
Oh, it's so cool. People have come out. I think the Q&A after a reading is probably my favorite part, because, you know, people who, a lot of whom have read the book, get to ask me all these questions. I love hearing what people are drawn to. Their favorite parts of the book are not necessarily my favorite parts of the book, and that's really cool. You know, the contact with readers at bookstores, but also the emails I've been getting. I'll tell you my favorite letter so far came from someone. It was just three sentences long. I memorized the whole thing. It said, "Dear Nathan Hill, I am very old. I have read a lot of books, and yours is among my favorite. Please don't take 10 years writing the next one. I'm 83. So, like, that is amazing. How can you not love that?
The ultimate vote of confidence. And there's some pressure there. You don't want to disappoint.
I wrote this person back immediately and said I was I'd be working really hard.
Nathan Hill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nathan Hill, the novel is The Nix, that's spelled N-I-X. He'll be in Iowa City for the Iowa City Book Festival, reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City Saturday, October 8th at 1 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.